Hi there, and welcome to Your Health, the podcast featuring NPR's best health reporting of the week. I'm Scott Hensley, impresario for Shots, NPR's health blog.
And I'm Eliza Barkley, a little impresaria, the small one, and a producer and reporter on the science desk. This week, we'll start by grilling Scott about some of his favorite blog posts.
Can't wait. Then we'll hear about marketing food to teenagers and the legacy of a forced sterilization program in North Carolina.
And we'll take a look at a study that came out this week that claimed a lot of companies would drop health coverage as Obama's health plan goes into effect.
Also, it's Shark Week here on the podcast. We talk about a new shark book, at least.
Before that, though, Scott, get us started here. I saw a post by our reporter Nancy Shute about hammocks being a great place to nap. I mean, duh, glad to know there's some research on this.
This is a study I would like to have been in. Some lucky people in Switzerland got to lie on a rocking bed simulating the sort of motion of a hammock so that sleep researchers could figure out what it was doing to their brains.
And what was it doing to their brains?
Well, they did fall asleep faster when this bed was rocking, and we have a picture of it on the blog. And more interestingly, there were aspects of their brain waves that indicated that they were getting a deeper, more restful sleep. So I think the bottom line is spend more time in your hammock if you don't have a rocking bed, and you'll be the better for it.
Wow. I am personally very inspired by this. Speaking of snoozing, well, it kind of reminds me of eating, actually. Another one of our favorite pastimes. This week, we also had something on some new research about what to eat to keep weight off as you get older.
I was fascinated by this too, Eliza, because I have a rooting interest for some of these foods, and I was sorry to see some that didn't do as well. But some Harvard researchers looked at a load of data on what people had been eating and how they gained weight over time, and they came up with a list of foods to avoid and foods you might think about eating more of.
Well, come on, we need to know. What can we eat? What is good for us? What will keep the weight off?
All right, let's start with the good ones. Nuts. Turns out people who ate more nuts gained less weight as they got older. Yogurt was another one that did quite well.
Why yogurt?
That is a good question, because some of the foods that were on the list up high were kind of obvious, like the whole grains and the nuts. There's a lot of research that suggests that things that are high in fiber and a little harder to digest, like those foods, may help you feel fuller and not want to eat as much. Yogurt doesn't really fall in that camp, but there is some research that suggests maybe the bacteria in yogurt are doing some things in your intestines that help you fight off weight gain. So it was clear that yogurt was a winner. So however it's working, that was one to think about, including in your diet if you're not doing it already.
Okay, so was there anything on the list of bad stuff that might actually surprise us? I mean, was it everything we think of? Deep fried, greasy, that stuff?
Fried foods were definitely on the list as things that contribute to this kind of weight gain. But there was a particular food item that I think everybody has in their house and loves to eat. Potatoes. Potato chips and French fries. But it didn't matter if it were mashed potatoes or baked potatoes. There was still an effect that the researchers saw.
Well, I guess it's not exactly news, but perhaps we all need a little reminder now and then that this potato is not your friend. So we've talked about some ways that nuts can be good for you, but nuts can also have some kind of bad effects in some people. Tell us about that. We had a post this week about food allergies, didn't we?
That's right. And nuts were at the top of the list of things that can cause allergies in kids. And some of those nut allergies can be very serious.
How does this add to what we already knew about food allergies in kids?
These numbers show that they're more common than some previous estimates, fairly recent estimates, and they also say something about the severity of them. There were around 39% of these allergies were classified as severe, and the group that was the most prone to having severe reactions was teenagers.
Interesting. Okay, so I can't resist. Can we please talk about fake boobs now?
If you insist, then I will. We had another post from Nancy Shute this week, the Food and Drug Administration. came out after years of study and said that silicone breast implants are generally safe. They had been suspected of having a role in a number of illnesses.
But there's a but coming, I know it.
Right. The but is the FDA said women should not think about these kinds of implants as a lifelong solution or a lifelong implant. The chances are that they're going to have something done about them, either taken out or replaced. And they talked about some common complications that develop over time and that they advise women to get regular MRIs to look for leakage of the implants.
That's a little disturbing, I'll say. Okay, so what can we look to for next week?
We're already working on some posts for next week, and a couple of them are going to be from Eliza. So I'm going to ask her to give a preview of houses and buildings and how they might improve your health.
Well, you don't normally think about your house being good for your health, but there are a couple of new interesting both sort of designs and actually products out there where a building or a house can have a direct impact on your health. One is in the area of air quality, and the other is in the area of infectious disease. So that's all I'm going to say.
All right.
Come back to the blog next week.
That's right. Come back to Shots, and you'll learn all about it next week.
Okay, let's continue in our food vein with a piece from NPR's Yuki Noguchi. We've reported before on efforts the government is making to limit junk food ads to kids. They want to limit exposure on TV, online, in schools, and in stores. Yuki reports for us on one of the most contentious parts of the discussion, whether the marketing limits should be applied to older kids, aged 12 to 17.
Parents are probably familiar with this kind of food lobby.
I always want pizza whenever I see a pizza commercial.
Do we get your pizza?
No.
13-year-old Reed Weisenberger is in Washington, D.C.'s Union Station with his mom, Cindy, and a group of his friends. Cindy Weisenberger dodges such requests regularly. Earlier, it was for giant caffeinated energy drinks.
These guys on our way here were wanting to buy Monster drinks, and I said, I'm not taking in kids that are drinking Monster drinks.
To those who want to limit kids' exposure to billions of dollars of food ads, the stakes are much higher than one parent's ongoing battle. About a third of U.S. adolescents are obese, and many blame successful marketing campaigns for contributing to the problem. The agencies drafting the guidelines call themselves the Interagency Working Group. In addition to the FTC and FDA, it includes the Agriculture Department and the Centers for Disease Control. This working group broke from the past by seeking to include 12 to 17-year-olds in its guidelines. Traditionally, limits on marketing focused on the very young. But the government wants to start including older kids because they are heavy consumers of social media, cell phone messages, and online games, the new frontier for ads.
What we're talking about are very complicated and subtle forms of marketing that aren't always clear as such.
Catherine Montgomery is a professor of communications at American University and an advocate for limiting food ads to teens. As an example, she cites an online ad sponsored by Doritos that mimics a horror movie. It draws in users' friends using Facebook and Twitter.
And then we made it personal. The more information you gave us at registration, the creepier the experience.
Montgomery says ads like these are immersive and work subliminally. They use friends to influence other friends. But efforts to restrict ads to teens draw a lot of opposition from the food and advertising industries. They say the overlap between the teen audience and the adult audience makes it too difficult to make restrictions practical. Elaine Kolisch directs an industry-funded program called the Children's Food and Beverage Advertising Initiative. For the past 5 years, this initiative sponsored its own voluntary standards that focus only on the 12 and under set.
You know, we let kids drive and we let them hold jobs when they're 16, and they can get married in some states and they can join the military with permission and they can be held criminally responsible for their actions in a number of situations. So I think that the notion that you'd have to have nutrition standards to say a kid can't see an ad for a French fry but they can join the military doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Advocates say whether the guidelines will include limits on teen marketing depends largely on how hard the government is willing to fight industry. Mary Engel is a director of advertising practices at the FTC. She doesn't sound like she's itching for a fight.
I think the application of the principles to the teenagers, it was definitely a point of contention, and the working group has already signaled that we recognize that and it may not be really feasible.
The public can submit comments to the working group until July 14th. The final version of the guidelines are expected by the end of the year. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Did you realize that the U.S. had a eugenics movement? In fact, I recommend checking out a June 1st post on NPR's Picture Show blog about that subject by Rich Remsberg. On All Things Considered this week, NPR reports that in North Carolina, the practice of sterilizing someone against their will continued into the 1970s. Now the state might compensate some of the victims, says reporter Julie Rose.
They were mostly poor and uneducated, both black and white, and often just girls.
My name is Elaine Riddick. I was sterilized at the age of 14.
The state of North Carolina said Riddick was promiscuous and didn't get along well with others.
I couldn't get along well with others because I was hungry. I was cold. I was a victim of rape.
Pregnant from that rape, Riddick gave birth to her only son in 1968. During the C-section, doctors sterilized her. A consent form shows the X mark of her illiterate grandmother. Riddick didn't know she'd been sterilized until she was 19, married and ready to have more kids. She's now 57 and shared her story, through tears, at a hearing of state officials today in Raleigh.
I have to get out what the state of North Carolina did to me. They cut me open like I was a hog.
Nearly 7,600 men, women, and children as young as 10 were sterilized under North Carolina's eugenics laws. While other state sterilization laws focused mainly on criminals and people in mental institutions, North Carolina was one of the few to expand its reach to women who were poor. Sterilization was seen as a way to limit the public cost of welfare. Social workers would coerce women to have the operation under threat of losing their public assistance. That's how 65-year-old Niall Ramirez lost her ability to have more children. She was too ill to attend today's hearing, but sent her daughter, Deborah Chesson, with a letter to read.
At the young age of 17, I was pregnant with my daughter, Deborah, living in a household with my mom and my siblings. My mother was a single mom, and times were tough, so we were on public assistance, just trying to survive. I was told that if I continued to have children, the livelihood of my family would suffer greatly.
The North Carolina Eugenics Board was created in 1933 and operated for decades with little public scrutiny. It used rudimentary IQ tests and gossip from neighbors to justify sterilization of young girls from poor families who hung around the wrong crowd or didn't do well in school. Girls like 13-year-old Leela Dunstan, who'd just had a baby. Dunstan is now 63.
I need a reward or something, some kind of compensation for all this that they done put me through.
North Carolina Governor Bev Perdue has now appointed a task force to consider compensating victims. In 1974, the Eugenics Board was disbanded, and the state formally apologized in 2002. Six other states have issued similar apologies, but none has compensated victims. If North Carolina lawmakers decide to pay victims, it could be costly. While the number of sterilizations in other states slowed down after the Nazi atrocities of World War II came to light, North Carolina's eugenics program ramped up. An estimated 3,000 victims are still living and could qualify for compensation. North Carolina State Representative Larry Womble is a key driver of the state's effort to make amends.
We have done some things that we should have never done before, and I'm glad that some of them are living long enough to see that something is being done. You are not forgotten.
The North Carolina Eugenics Task Force will make a preliminary recommendation on compensating victims in August. For NPR News, I'm Julie Rose in Raleigh.
States are grappling with a lot of healthcare issues, including the ongoing transition to the Obama healthcare plan. A new report says nearly a third of businesses are likely to stop offering health insurance to their employees when the new law takes effect in the year 2014. But NPR's Julie Rovner explains to Robert Siegel that the consultants that did the study are not being transparent about how they conducted it.
To begin, let's be blunt. There have been enough surveys and studies on what last year's healthcare law might or might not do to fill library shelves, if not entire libraries. What's so different about this one to make it so important?
Well, there's two things. First, McKinsey is a very well-respected firm in the health policy community. And second, the finding that almost a third of employers said they would, quote, definitely or probably stop offering health insurance in the years after 2014 was really quite eye-popping. And it was one that obviously was going to be repeated a lot by opponents of the law.
And this finding is actually quite different from that of lots of other studies that have posed the same question?
Absolutely, and by a lot. The Congressional Budget Office, the RAND Corporation, the Urban Institute, several other groups have all looked at the question of how many employers are likely to drop coverage under the law. And remember, most employers will have to pay a penalty if they do that. And all of those studies have found the likely change will be much smaller. But you don't have to just look at studies to wonder about this. There's at least one real-world example, and that's up in Massachusetts, where they've required individuals to have health insurance for 4 years now. And in Massachusetts, access to employer health insurance has actually increased. It's gotten easier.
On the other hand, one could say, you know, the economy is a moving target. This is a study that's come up with a different finding, but not necessarily an incorrect finding. What is it about the study that raises eyebrows?
Well, what really got people suspicious was that McKinsey has been refusing to release its methodology, how it did the study. They said they interviewed 1,300 employers for the study, but no one knew whether they were large employers or small employers, which makes a very large difference. We didn't know if they talked to human resources directors or to owners of companies, so they might not have even surveyed the people who can make the decisions about whether companies will continue to offer health insurance. And I spoke to several independent pollsters, including people at the American Association for Public Opinion Research. They said while they're not the polling police, if someone does a survey and refuses to release its methodology, that raises a big red flag.
And then the politicians got into it.
That's right. Democrats, of course, are worried that this number will take hold. We're already seeing Republican presidential candidates using it out on the campaign trail. So yesterday, Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus and 9 top House Democrats basically demanded that McKinsey release the methodology it used to do the survey. Now McKinsey says it will, although we haven't seen it just yet.
Julie, is there a chance that this study is accurate and that all the other studies are actually underestimating how many employers think they'll probably drop coverage after 2014?
Well, there is, and I've talked to at least one health policy consultant today who I do trust a lot who does believe that. But, you know, there's another important point about all of this. One pollster I spoke to pointed out that even if the survey is valid, there's so many things that are still unknown about how the law will actually roll out between now and 2014. There's regulations still to come. It's still unknown what these health insurance exchanges will look like. There's other things that are still yet to be decided. It's likely that no employer really knows what they will or won't do in 2014 or slightly after that. So you really need to take all of these surveys with a really big grain of salt.
Okay, that's NPR health policy correspondent Julie Rovner. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Finally, it's Shark Week here on the podcast.
Yes. So we can be funny about this and all, but actually, did you know that Peter Benchley, who wrote the book Jaws, has said that if he'd written that book 20 years later, he wouldn't have made the shark such a villain?
I had no idea.
Well, if you want to know more about sharks, other fun facts, you can check out Juliet Eilperin's book. She is an environmental reporter for The Washington Post, and she has a new book out called Demon Fish, Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks. And Scott Simon talked to her recently and asked her who the real predator is, man or shark.
The man. We're the ones who are the dangerous ones. Although it's not that sharks are without their dangers, but if you want to say who poses the greater threat between the two, there's no question it's humans.
Because?
Because we crave sharks both for their fins, so that we can put it into an Asian delicacy that's shark fin soup. We catch them by accident. And then some people like to go catch them so they can create fiberglass trophies and tell tales to their friends. And as a result, we're killing somewhere between 80 and 100 million sharks a year, where by comparison, sharks kill between 4 and 5 people on average worldwide.
You point out that we're not particularly appetizing to them, are we?
We're not fatty enough. We don't have enough on us. So, in fact, often what, you know, when a great white attacks someone, they do the bite and spit. They take a bite hoping that we're a seal, and they spit us out. You know, what you see in the movie and this total consumption of humans is not usually what happens.
So relax. At most, it'll be a foot or something like that.
Exactly. It's not to minimize it, but if it's any consolation, we now have a 90% chance of surviving a shark strike. So that's a lot better odds than it was around the turn of the last century.
Do sharks and humans share some traits?
They do. We have some evolutionary traits. I mean, the muscles that we use to chew and to talk actually come from sharks. Now, in terms of personality traits, it depends how you define it. But
Washington lawyers and sharks.
Exactly.
But other than that, can we coexist or do we have competing interests on this planet?
Well, it depends how you look at it, but I think there are many ways in which we could consider ourselves allies. Basically, sharks are essential for maintaining the balance in the ecosystems because, as you said, they're one of the top predators, and they really keep mid-level predators in check so that we can have all sorts of species and healthy coral reefs. And for that reason, it's actually more in our interest to keep them around than to get rid of them.
And how accurate is the image, you know, the rep that we've hung on sharks, that they're the predators of the sea?
Well, to some extent, it makes sense. I mean, basically, they are relentless predators. It's why they've been able to survive for hundreds of millions of years. They're incredibly good at what they do. It's just that they're not targeting us. The way Christopher Neff, a researcher in Australia, puts it is that we're in the way but not on the menu. So I think that's our biggest misconception. But in other ways, you know, sharks can be pretty brutal. Some of them eat each other in utero. They abandon their young. So again, they're not saints by any means.
Are they as ancient as dinosaurs?
They're more ancient. They predate dinosaurs by roughly 200 million years.
Wow.
Yeah, and then what's really interesting, when you do the DNA, like some people like Steve Palumbia, Stanford University professor, has done, what you see is they haven't changed that much over time. Mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons why they're pretty ill-equipped to adapt to whether it's intense fishing pressure or ocean acidification. There are things that are happening now that they never had to contend with over the course of, again, hundreds of millions of years.
You've noted that the sharks, in fact, can fairly be considered pretty nasty predators.
Right.
But perhaps not nearly as bad as that movie Jaws. How did they get cast as the other?
I mean, I think there's this primordial fear that we have of them because, frankly, particularly with island cultures, they were more closely tied to the sea. They were going out to sea, and many of them were having interactions with sharks. So I think that, you know, they are one of the few creatures that can attack us with no warning. And I think we came to see them as evil, I think, partially during seafaring times.
Feel differently about sharks now that you've gotten to know them?
I do. I'm not obsessed with them, and I don't, maybe love is not the right word for them, but I have both incredible respect for this animal that's managed to survive for so long. And I do a little bit of affection. I think that they're beautiful creatures, and that's something I didn't really think before getting in the water with them. But now that I've seen them up close and in lots of different contexts, I just think there's really nothing else like them.
Thanks so much. Going swimming soon?
Yeah, I'm going to do a lot of coastal visits, and I plan to get in the water.
Okay. All right. Coming from you, that means a lot. Juliet Eilprin of the Washington Post, her new book, Demonfish, Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks. And you can read Juliet's description of a Hong Kong shark fin market on our website, npr.org.
All right. That's it for this week. And thanks for listening. I'm Eliza Barkley.
And I'm Scott Hensley. See you later.